Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hello and welcome to Audiovisual Cultures, the podcast where I, your host, Paula Blair, investigate different areas of film, media, the arts, and cultural production. In this episode, I am delighted to share with you a recording I made with Newcastle-based artist Richard James Hall for the Slacks Radio Residency at the Newbridge Project, about which you can find more information by following the links in the show notes, wherever you're listening to this. Dick is a very dear friend of mine and a big supporter of this show, and I've been wanting to do a recording with them for a while, so this was a really lovely way to go about that, and I'm really grateful to Newbridge and Slacks for the opportunity. If you'll recall, Dick featured on our special Remembering Sally Madge episode last autumn, and it's great now to talk to Dick personally about their own practice, which is largely through process and performance art. And if you've been listening for a while, you know that's a big interest of mine, is live performance art. So before I pass over to our past selves, huge thanks to all our listeners and to our very generous benefactors over at patreon.com/AVCultures. All of you that make doing this and my very busy January with all of these recordings very worthwhile. If you love what I'm doing with the show and you can't manage to support the work financially, I'd really appreciate a positive review and rating wherever you access the podcast, and a boost on your socials would also be really, really appreciated. I'm so grateful when people do that. It really means a lot. But if you can manage even just a one-off few quid, I'd be so grateful for that. You can do that directly on our lovely upgraded website funded by our patrons at audiovisualcultures.com, where you can also sign up to our mailing list to receive our free monthly newsletter and new episode notifications straight to your inbox, as well as access transcripts and generally get more information and links for everything to do with me and the show. So for now, before you run off and do all of that, I want you to really enjoy this insightful chat with Dick James Hall. I know I really enjoy all my talks with Dick. Richard James Hall, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much for inviting me, Paula.
It's great to catch up. So my first question, would you be happy to describe your practice for everyone?
In the short term, I would say I am a performance artist based in Newcastle upon Tyne. The longer way about it is I'm a performance artist who also does other kinds of work on the side, and has come from a tradition of improvisational performance, but also realizing and having to think about now the factor of how much being on the autistic spectrum, being queer, being fat even, affects myself and the world around me. It's a very strange questioning that I'm having to go through. And I'm constantly questioning it myself, which makes it very hard to think about projects, to be honest. Practice-wise, I'm just like taking it day by day, week by week, year by year. That's the really long, tangential point about it. But that's about how I would describe my practice so far.
Okay, brilliant. Mm-hmm. Thanks. I've had the great privilege of being able to see your live performance in the before times when it was safe to gather.
Mm.
But I also really enjoyed, over the lockdown periods, your experimental Wednesday performances on Instagram Live. And I think those are where you really explored a lot of those kinds of themes that you just flagged up there about identity and taking up space and moving through space and playing with objects and just the live work, but doing it towards camera. I really enjoyed that a lot. As well as those, what else specifically would you say you've been working on recently? And I think we can be very elastic about what we mean by recent there. What else would you say you've been working on? Because I know you do a lot of drawing as well.
I was doing a lot of drawing, and I kind of hit a sort of roadblock. Because recently, about a few months ago, I was invited to do my first performance to audience in over 3 years, actually, for No Trace Without Resistance, which was a memorial event for the late, great Sally Madge. And for that, I was in a lab coat, which I had to order in because I thought about wearing Sally's lab coat. She was very, very much smaller than me. So I ordered in a lab coat, and that lab coat seen some action the days before that event, including doing a trip from Shieldfield on the bus, where all the people are like going like, keep away from me from the testing site. And I'm in the middle of town going through all the charity shops because I was looking for china plates and china teacups and all that for Sandra Johnston, also a fantastic performance artist. And I'm just like going through each charity shop going like, no, no. And I'm ending up with this bunch of plates and all this china. And I'm like going, is this right? It's called gold trimming. I'll buy it. But on the day itself, I had a lint roller. I had a few lint rollers, some fine French chalk. And I'm just, throughout the day, I was just rolling this lint roller over the venue cinema seats because the venue itself was a Star and Shadow cinema. And I'm just rolling away, trying to gather up dust, hair, the little bits of fabric and all that that's left behind from use. And it was interesting actually seeing how much of the past is picked up by this. This dust, this mark of time, which was very much a tradition that Sally Madge basically used within her practice, which was to pick up on the mundane things and to celebrate it. So I did that for about 5 hours. In terms of other things, apart from being ill with some sort of mysterious bacterial and viral infection, I saw a really interesting piece of performance work by another artist called Victoria Gray. And I actually wrote, it's very rare that I write in response to artworks, but this one just struck me because she actually was addressing being on the autistic spectrum and actually being recently diagnosed as being on the autistic spectrum, which was really interesting to me. And as I'm writing it and I sent it off and I reread it, I'm going, oh, I'm picking up on stuff that I have experienced, that a few people who I have known have also experienced. So in a way, my practice is fairly elastic. And recently, I've also been working on a sort of soft practice launch of a survey of Sally Madge's work. And part of that was trying to install some of her work in ways that isn't academically structured or institutionally structured, but actually played about with as if you are the artist. So I've been piling up cuddly toys into the corner of the room. I've been trying to stand up cushions which demand to let me fall down, and just constantly having this on-off discussion about how certain things come alive with the artist touch rather than perhaps the curatorial touch. So I've been having a bit of discussion with a couple of other people about that, about how the curator is meant to care about work, and yet it's us, the artists, who actually seem to be showing the most care and the most dynamic form of care, which is to actually bring to life those works, which were so inanimate, and also think about how it is the process itself that brings those works to life. It's not just like an institutional taxonomizing process, but that's a very... This is also where you can tell I've been doing an MA and hung around PhD students for quite a long time, because I have that critical thought process.
That's really useful insight, actually. I really appreciate those ideas. I think that's a lovely way of putting it as well, is that idea of taking care of the art, not just putting it somewhere and seeing where it looks nice, you know, but actually caring for it. And the cushions you're talking about, especially because those are fragments of fabric that Sally painstakingly quilted together. And they've been washed up on the shore, so dear knows where they came from, and it's bits of clothes and things, you know, so they're very human. I think her intention was to give them some sort of dynamism and life, and they're all different shapes and sizes, just like humans are, and they're knobbly and they're baggy and they're... too full in some bits, and just like humans are, and they're coming apart, or they're, you know, they're so sewn together, they're ruffled up. It's really wonderful to hear that you've been able to play with those and have that live experience, because I think that's where the best of performance art really comes out, is when you play with things and you have the opportunity to play and sometimes let the material lead you and you facilitate it rather than force it into something.
I think that's the key part of any sort of improvisational performance practice. It's all fine and well having the envisioned idea, but sometimes you have to let yourself be led by the materials, the sight, the people around you. You're very much in a dynamic state. It's very hard to actually stay static. I admire some artists who actually do durational static work, where they're just so slow that the melt happens. I've tried that once for an hour. I couldn't do it. I haven't got the practice or the patience for it. I'm very much like a tangential practitioner. Either something catches my interest or I'm kind of bored.
Okay.
That sounds really childish in a way. But it's just my way of going about it. I like the dynamism. I like to be invigorated somehow. But of course, there's also moments where you have to take stock and you have to stand back and actually kind of go like, this is now a time to lull a little bit.
Do you find that these are quite intuitive processes? Do you just really listen to yourself and see what you need to do? Or how much do you allow yourself to, you know, to what extent would you plan something before you go into it? Or do you just have an idea and you see what happens?
I would say I have an idea. It's very rare that I have the overall vision of something. It's much more on the emotional scale for me. There's no hard structures to really work with, apart from perhaps the site itself. There are some things you just can never force or change. You can't change your environment entirely without great pains to do so.
Okay.
Your materials, there's a level of care with materials, but there's also a level of understanding that once you do something destructive, you basically have took away some of its original intent, and you have to live with that, and you have to clean up after that. I've learned from experience that you have to take responsibility as a performance artist, that in a way you are having to show care to the site, to the materials, or understand that there is consequences once you destroy the materials. People around you, because people are unpredictable, and there may be times where you may have to shift out a little bit from performance, from one performance state to another state, to react to another person who may be in the audience. And at the end of the day, you also have to care for yourself, because it's all nice and well when you have other people supporting you, but sometimes when you're actually by yourself, as I have been throughout some of the Experiment Wednesdays and throughout some of the experiments I've had done in public realm works before, you are basically having to take care of yourself and understand what you need to do to recuperate or what you need to watch out for. So there's a responsibility to the play as well. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that's something I'm growing into.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because when you're young, you're sort of slapdash. Oh, God. I actually was in a workshop once, and this kid basically, he just was going off on one. Mm-hmm. Like, he actually was just, like, destroying everything mm-hmm. around him. And at the end of it, because we let him go through this, we let him do what he did. And at the end of it, I just basically said to him, in a way, that was like saying, I have been in that place. I have been in that destructive area. But you have to be aware now that your destruction has caused an effect around you. So in a way, I was kind of kicking his ass, but in a sort of caring way.
Mm-hmm.
I was trying to show a level of care by actually kind of going like, I'm kicking your ass right now, but only because I want you to learn.
Mm.
But of course, some people don't do that. And I may be one of the few people to actually step up to the plate of going like...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, giving them what for.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So, Dick, you've been a member of Newbridge for a while.
Mm.
Would you say that there might be anything you've learned from being part of Newbridge, or any experiences that you've had particular to Newbridge? Or is there anything you can reflect on about just your experience of being a member?
I would say, as with any studio situation, it varies from studio to studio. I've been in some tight-knit studios where I'm sharing one room with maybe four artists, or I may be sharing this massive garage with 8 to 11 artists with no boundary points. And it's interesting to me how Newbridge, first of all, it allows the boundary space so that your studio is your studio. And that's something that in some ways I've really craved because I'm quite a messy studio holder. I'm not icky messy. I had one studio member years ago, and this was the last straw for me. We had a shared fridge and he basically left wild mushrooms in the fridge for about a week. And when I opened the fridge, it's like, no. I actually had to get everything out of that fridge, chuck out the mushrooms, and try to clean out that entire fridge, and it still smelled of mushroom. For all the bleach and all that I could put in, it just was like, nope, that smell's not going.
Mm.
What I'm finding with Newbridge is, for the fact that even though you may have separate studios, there's still a community, which I really appreciate. I'm talking to artists who have just graduated from university, and I'm like trying to give them like the little things of like, yeah, try to keep your practice up for at least 2 years so you can at least keep up the momentum. Because the amount of people who do art courses and then they don't continue their practice, you kind of lose the momentum and you lose the want to do art if you don't keep a practice up. But it's interesting as well, having talked and worked with members of staff at Newbridge as well, there is a level of care and there is a level of wanting things to change, both within the studio settings, but also in the wider spectrum of the community.
Mm-hmm.
Over the last few years, especially since I've only came into Newbridge September 2019, and there's been times where members of that community have actually supported me when I have been at my lowest lows.
Mm-hmm.
I actually had Rebecca give me a call over lockdown once, Rebecca Huggin, director of Newbridge. And she basically just wanted to check in on me.
Mm.
That's something that I don't think a lot of institutions usually do. And I think that shows the amount of care that Newbridge shows towards its members. But of course, sometimes members also push their luck a little bit, and Newbridge won't be afraid to just basically go, sort your shit out. Don't leave your stuff ready for arsonists to start fires with. I feel like it's also like it's a mix of training ground for recent graduates, but also it allows space for older artists to work in a studio setting amongst the community, especially with how space is a premium now, especially in cityscapes. I've heard of studios outside of the city, but it's usually people who have a little bit more money or a little bit more know-how about how the infrastructure works. And I'm not quite at that place now, financially or know-how to actually kind of have a space outside yet. But I really appreciate Newbridge on that level. It's just a nice space. It's somewhere where I would recommend any recent graduates to apply for, especially if they're local based.
Great. I was wondering if you have any thoughts about the arts in Newcastle quite generally and across the Northeast region that you'd be happy to share. I mean, you mentioned, for example, Newbridge being in Shieldfield, and that's quite a recent move, and premises in the city centre. But do you have any thoughts about what the art scene's like and what it's like in the city and in the region?
I would say Newcastle as an art scene itself is a fairly tightly knit group. Although there are times where there are people who I see who are artists who I recognize, but I don't quite know of. But there's always that sort of thing of when you're walking down the street and you see somebody you just know from the scene, and you just give them the slight tilt of a nod just to kind of go like, I see you. And of course, I'm not entirely beneficial neither, because sometimes if I don't get the tilt of a nod back when I've gave the tilt of a nod back, and it's like, I'm just like...
For the audio, that was two flips of the bird there.
I think as well, in terms of Newcastle, it is a little bit of a struggle at times, because the Northeast as a region has always kind of struggled with the arts, because we've always been seen as like the leftover region in England itself. If anything, there are some people in other regions of England who actually consider Newcastle and Northeast actually be part of Scotland.
Yeah.
So there's these questions of like, would we be better off if we were in adopted by the Scottish, or do we have to really fight harder for funding? But it's also that case of Newcastle has some of the freeway to actually experiment with work, because economically rent here is not too bad. It's actually fairly cheap compared to some other regions where it's more popular to live, and it has produced some really great artists over the years. But what I'm finding as well is some of the great artists that I know of are known only locally. There's the likes of Carol Luby and Sally Madge, for example, who they're artists who are locally known and they're admired locally. But outside of the region, it's very much like nobody quite knows, and I find that quite shocking. I actually went down to the Live Art Development Agency in London, trying to type up performance artists from Newcastle-upon-Tyne. There was very little, even though we have a very rich history of performance and experimental arts.
Yeah.
It's shocking, but it's also not shocking at the same time. And then you have to take it as it is. You kind of have to take the factor of, you can have a practice here, but you may have to explore outside of the region itself just to get work. But I will say people from Newcastle have a very good sort of party community as well. We love to celebrate our own when one of our own actually succeeds at something. We're like, yes, yes. And when maybe an institution or something lets itself down, we're kind of like going, God, why? And of course, with any sort of tight-knit community, there's also like a bit of gossip, a bit of chatting behind people's backs. And it's either done lovingly or it's done with a bit of
But you wouldn't do anything like that, Dick, I'm sure.
Well, I do like to spill a little bit of tea now and again and have a good sort of laugh.
Yeah.
I'm not afraid to basically say to some people, I have said to some fairly successful mid-career artists, bullshit. I'm not afraid because I'm now at a point, I'm 35, I know I'm not going to be like famous or have the money. I'm just being honest to myself, to the community around me, and also just kind of going like, time is precious. If you're not going to be honest, it sometimes leads to bad situations, whereas the honesty itself can actually be quite transformative and can help take away some of the egotism. The one thing I will say is we could probably do with a little bit more criticality, but in the sense of kind of going like we're being critical, but in a supportive manner. And I have said some things which have probably put me in the bad books with a few people. I've had a few conversations with curators just kind of going like, really? But it's just life. I love it here. It's the one place I feel the most me at, because I tried doing it down in London. London does my head in. London's a place I know I had to visit at least maybe before pandemic. I knew I had to visit at least once a year because it's just the way of the world. But if I could help it, I wouldn't go down to London as much. But I try to also bring news of Newcastle to people outside of the region and just kind of go like, come.
Yeah, it's a lot more vibrant than it's made out to be.
You just have to scratch the surface a little bit and not be afraid of, because sometimes we'll hang about in some of the dingy parts of town as well and just be like, it's not as bad as it looks. I had one taxi driver try to pick me up once, a biker, and he just was like, oh, it's a bit rough here, like. And I was like, have you been in Birtley or Chesley Street or anywhere like that? Like, I just went, it's not that rough, dear. I've been through and come through rougher places before, and I'm just like, this is a breeze.
Dick, thank you so much for this. Where can people find out more about you and your work? Where would you point them towards online?
You can look me up on Instagram at Dick James Hall, because people also call me Dick. I call myself sometimes Miss Dick, Mrs. Dick, Major Dick. One day I hope to be Dr. Dick.
That'd be awesome.
Yes. And website, I have www.richardjameshall.weebly.com. You might just want to type in Richard James Hall artist and just give it a go that way.
Yes.
You know you're on the right page when you see somebody who's just like quite fat with long hair, and the first image is like just me on the floor going like,
that's what to look out for, folks.
Oh, thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been an absolute pleasure. I always love our chats, and it's been brilliant to have this proper, more formal chat with you today. And I really appreciate it, and I hope you have a lovely rest of your day.
Thank you so much. I hope to get to spill some more tea with you soon.
Boys, a dear, it's cold today. All right. I just wanted to extend my thanks to Dick again for this, and I hope that they'll return so that we can go into a lot more detail on a lot of those issues raised there. Because I think there are things that we started to touch on that merit a lot more depth, but I was recording this for quite a tight time slot, so it was a fairly concise conversation. So I thought I'd just take the opportunity now. I'm recording this in February, doing a bit of time travelling, because that talk was, I probably said this earlier, it was originally recorded in January, around mid-January. It's early-ish February, and yeah, it's a really nice opportunity actually to listen back over these and reflect on them a little bit and to get some ideas on how to maybe develop some more of these themes and issues that are coming up across these episodes. The next one is going to be the third of the recordings that I did for this with Bethany Stead. So that's a really lovely conversation as well. So please do keep subscribing and check that out as well. But yeah, so I just thought I'd take a minute, because that has been a fairly short one, to just reflect a bit more on some of the observations. I think there's a lot of crossover here with the professional and the personal through some of the things that Dick was referring to there. I'd really like to acknowledge that we seem a bit snippy about art curators and more formal and institutionalized approaches to presenting work in galleries and exhibitions. I mean, I try and be really open-minded, but you know, sometimes you slip up, and I slipped up in this one a bit and probably come across as a bit negative, in part due to not great practices we encountered around the commemorative events for Sally Madge that we mentioned, and those events took place in November 2021. And I just want to be really, really clear, every single person who works on all of those events and the exhibition and everything, we all contributed our time for free. The curators particularly did so at quite great personal cost to themselves, and it was hugely stressful under very challenging circumstances and very limiting circumstances as well. But on the other side of that, they also didn't listen to the wishes of those of us who actually worked directly with Sally's pieces, and I felt that they made some presentation decisions that they thought looked nice, looked as good as they could in the space that they were given. But I think there were others of us who felt that these particular presentations of specific things were missteps. I am being deliberately vague here. I'm not naming things directly. I'm not going to name any people. I just felt that, you know, there were quite a few of us who had a lot more knowledge and understanding of the context around a lot of the work, and physically worked with them as well. I did a lot of finishing of Sally's unfinished pieces. Not just me, other people did that sort of work as well. So there was a lot of very invisible labour that went behind getting the pieces ready for exhibition and also for Sally's physical archive. And I just felt that the missteps in how some of these were presented in the gallery, it probably shed a potentially negative light. If you were a viewer who came in cold and you really engaged actively with the piece and thought it through, I don't think you'd have come to a very positive conclusion. So again, I'm being really vague, but if you witnessed it or if you've seen images of it, you might be able to work out what I'm talking about, but I'm not going to talk about it directly. And there is a little bit of my thinking on this, because I wrote a blog post thinking through issues around art labour, and that's something I talked at length with Sally about. There's also a particular thing that happened with something I made that I posted on my personal Instagram page. So if you want to go digging, you're welcome to go and hunt through those, but I'm not going to link to them directly. As I say, I don't want to name any names, and I don't actually think it's worth really dwelling on too much. And this is probably, I hope, the last I'll probably talk about this, but everybody who was involved contributed with the absolute best of intentions. And this isn't a hill that I think is worth dying on. Just what I will say, I think it's more, it sparked, rather than the personal, it sparked more of an intellectual curiosity about art labour and the worth of work. And those sorts of things, again, all things I talked about often with Sally and I keep bringing up on this podcast. Nobody seems to be getting the message. Not enough people are listening to it, or maybe everybody listens to this gets the message, and I need more of these people to listen and get the message. So what I would like to say is that I would like to see more respect and consideration for art labourers, art workers, and recognition that an artist might have their name on something, but they don't necessarily make the work. And in Sally's case, that was different because she died. She was making the work herself and then she died. And so a bunch of us finished it or did something with the things that were in transition. But it's something that I was thinking about a lot anyway with, sort of more bigger name, famous artists who get loads of money thrown at them or make loads of money in their work. Sally wasn't one of those people. But even still, even just that work of doing that labour, you know, I gave a lot of my summer last year to doing the work of putting these pieces together and finishing things. And I don't care about recognition, but what happened in my case was that something of mine was actually destroyed. So it's not just that, you know, I don't care about being erased. I don't care about being visible, but something I actually made and did with my bare hands was destroyed in the process of this. So it really spun me on a train of thought of thinking about art labourers and art labourers who are at once the same as and distinct from artists. So this is an issue that was presented front and centre in so much of Sally's work, to the point that she did performances for which she made pin badges that said flux worker on them. And that was specific to when she was responding through performance to the Fluxus retrospective at Baltic in 2009. And this was a performance that pushed what Dick was talking about there in artists caring for other artists' work to real extremes, quite funny extremes, but also she was provocative of that, and I'll link to some of that work in the show notes. And so in turn, that's what a few of us did for Sally's work in the year following her death. We cared for her work. I felt very personally close to Sally when I was working with her pieces. You know, I would have her, some of her cushions sitting on me while I closed them up. And that was very meaningful because it felt like I could hug this thing that was part of her, and it was very personal. But that's not the piece that I'm really talking about. I think the thing that was really hurtful for me on a personal level was that an embroidered dedication, a very small embroidered dedication I had put on one of the really large pieces I had made out of the bits Sally never got to, was ripped out without me being notified, without me being asked. I turned up to the opening night and I saw that it was gone, and I thought I was going mad, and only I had taken a photograph of it at home before I gave it away. I knew I wasn't going completely mad, and I had actually sewn this in, and it was just ripped out. It was completely gone. It wasn't even just covered over. It was just gone. And so I think there's quite a few layers to this, because obviously it was personally a bit of an affront, but then it also felt a lot more generally like an affront to the visibility of the art worker emerging from the artist's shadow. And this was something Sally did quite a lot in her art. She laid bare the process of the work around making art. If you listen back to my episode with her, one of her performances called Making a Mess and Cleaning It Up, her whole performance is about, you know, she does an artwork in a space, and then most of the performance is actually her cleaning up the mess that she's made for the performance. So there's a collapse of the artwork and the art labour, and the what is performance and what is just cleaning up. They collapse into each other. In a very, very tiny way, this was something I was referencing, was just to making the work a bit visible. And mine obviously isn't terribly profound, and I wouldn't claim anything like that, but it's just in my own little way, doing something that I think Sally may have approved of and that I discussed with her quite a bit. Now, on the other layer to that is that embroidery and needlework are considered as crafts rather than art. Again, this is something that has come up in the podcast before. If you go back to one of our earlier episodes as well, called Hard Craft, this is something that me and my guests in that episode talk about at length as well, is what processes, what methods are even considered to be art. So my hand-stitched embroidered writing wasn't considered art by these curators. And I mean, I don't know their thinking about it because they haven't spoken to me. And that's part of the problem, is that they have never communicated with me. I spoke to them on the opening night before I had realised what had happened. And just even speaking to them for a few minutes, it was really clear that there was a lot they didn't know about the pieces that I and another person had finished and the pieces that I by myself had made. There was just so much detail they didn't have, and they have my email address. I'm easy to reach, I'm easy to find. I put myself all over the internet. I'm not hiding anywhere, folks. Again, there's a lot going on there, so I don't want to just whinge about it too much. But yeah, so it got me thinking about, not just for me on a personal level, but for just those larger questions. I think about who gets to be an artist, what gets to be an artwork, what gets to be an art process. You know, I think we're still not answering those questions adequately. With Sally's death, there is now another lack in who is asking those questions through the work itself, through the process itself. And so I suppose I just really wanted to add that on, because there remains no consensus on how any of these things can really be properly defined and who gets to define that. And I suppose it presented us with the fact that there is still very stringent gatekeeping of the boundaries around creative practice. Creative practices. And so I thought I would just throw those extra observations out there and just ask you to think about that for a bit. So thanks if you've listened to my little extra ramble. Huge thanks again to Dick. I hope that that's got that out of my system. Thank you for listening. Thank you for tuning in to this Cozy Pea Pod production. If you got something out of this episode, we'd really appreciate it if you could give us a good rating wherever you're accessing it and share it with someone you know will find it really interesting. If early releases and bonus content sound appealing, visit patreon.com/avcultures and join one of our support tiers. If you want to help the show but can't manage a membership, we'd love you to join the conversation with AV Cultures Pod on Instagram, Facebook, or Twitter. The music is Common Ground by Airtone, used under a 3.0 Creative Commons non-commercial license, and is available at ccmixer.org. I've been Paula Blair, and you've been a fantastic audience. Mind yourselves, until next time.